Hey, this is CJ, your humble hazardous history helmsman, back with another dastardly dose of dangerous history. This is episode 158 of the Dangerous History Podcast, and in this episode, I'm talking with Tom Secker, who is a researcher and writer and podcaster out of the UK, who has done a lot of important work on a bunch of interesting topics, including the topic that is our primary topic of conversation in this episode, which is National Security Cinema, which is also the title of a book that Tom co-wrote. And it's the idea of the degree to which the military and intelligence and security agencies of the state exercise significant influence on the entertainment industry. Tom's website, where he writes and also hosts his podcast, is spyculture.com, and I will be sure to link to that in the show notes for this episode. And also his podcast, which I highly recommend, is the cleverly named Clandestime. And I've become a big fan of Tom's work over the past year or so, so I was very happy to be able to talk with him for a while, and I think you'll really enjoy this episode. Now, unfortunately, transatlantic Skype calls being what they are, we do have some audio gremlins with Tom's side of the conversation, which I did my best to try to clean up, but it's still not pristine, and I hope you won't mind, and I really think the quality of the conversation is such that despite some audio hiccups, it still very much will reward your listening to it. But before I get to that, I do have some awesome individuals to thank for signing up to support the Dangerous History Podcast via Patreon. So big thanks go to Curtis and to Kenneth. Thank you both very much for signing up to support the show over at patreon.com/profcj. And just as a reminder to all of you out there in listener land, that if you sign up to support the show for $5 per month or more, I'll thank you by name in the next episode I make, and in addition, you'll have access to special bonus episodes available nowhere else, and also you will get early access to ad-free versions of regular Dangerous History Podcast episodes as well, and also, should you desire, you'll be eligible to join our private Facebook group. So, I hope you'll consider supporting the show via Patreon if you're not already doing so. And by the way, I really, really could use some more supporters on Patreon. As I've said before, and as you can see, if you go to patreon.com/profcj, I'm trying to get to at least $1,500 a month of support there so that I can step away from teaching summer school. And being able to do that would make a huge difference in terms of freeing up significant amounts of time for me to put additional work into the podcast that I simply don't have available right now. And now, my conversation with Tom Secker. All right, Tom Secker, thanks for taking some time to be on the Dangerous History Podcast with me today.
Thanks for having me. It's great to be talking to you. I'm looking forward to this.
Yeah, well, I've become a big fan of your work over the last year or so. And in particular, you know, you do work on a bunch of different things, but in particular, what hooked me was your work on the influence of kind of military and intelligence and security agencies over mainstream TV and movies, especially in America. But of course, you know, a lot of American entertainment dominates much of the rest of the world. And I appreciate your research and your analysis. And also, I have to say, your kind of dry sense of humor when you're presenting things. So if I may be kind of presumptuous, you seem to be, from my reading and listening of you, to be kind of in a similar place where I am, in terms of just overall frame of mind, when it comes to things like conspiracies, especially conspiracies that involve some sort of national security state type apparatus. And what I mean by we're kind of in the same realm is it seems to me you don't automatically buy the official story on things, but you also don't just uncritically accept every kind of half-baked conspiracy theory either. In other words, you also kind of approach the alternative theories with a bit of a skeptical eye. And I've referred to myself in the past as kind of a moderate conspiracy theorist, for lack of a better term. What are your thoughts kind of overall on the whole concept of conspiracy and like where you think your work and your analysis fits into this?
Well, like you, I like the phrase moderate conspiracy theorist. I think that's probably quite appropriate for a fair number of us. I'm coming from the same sort of place you are, that generally speaking, I don't believe official stories, or certainly not government official stories of major events or whatever it is, really. But then I don't find a huge amount of satisfaction and tangible evidence and good reasoning in alternative versions. You know, there's a lot of, with any of these events where there is a lot of media attention, especially, you generally get certain sections of the alternative media piling in very, very quickly, trying to fit this event in, or this suspicious element of this event, into their pre-established view of how these things go down. And whether this is a, you know, terrorist attack, mass shooting, it's usually a criminal event of some sort. But also natural disasters, they tend to fall into this. Political scandals too. Even that mysterious event when the Pope retired early, and there was sort of, you know, odd goings on at the Vatican. You know, all of these sorts of things, people very, very quickly tried to fit this into some kind of preformed analysis that would, it essentially was there to reinforce that analysis rather than actually shed any light on the particular event itself. So I have a lot of problems with that. I understand how people get drawn into that kind of mentality, that kind of, you know, circular confirmation bias. But I think it's something, if you take this stuff seriously, it's something you have to try and avoid. And you have to keep going back to the evidence, and you have to keep going back to, what do we actually know here? What are the important questions arising from that, rather than just every question that a skeptic can have? And, you know, progress from there. And so, when you look at the popular culture thing, for example, when I started this in 2010, I guess, informally, and in quite a formal way, 2012, 2013, and that's when I set up the site, Spy Culture, there was a reasonable amount of academic coverage, but it was quite conservative in its thinking. Not necessarily politically conservative, just it wasn't very bold in what it was saying. And then on the flip side, you had the conspiracy culture, the alt media, the online media, whatever you want to call it, where they seemed to think that every weird or suspicious thing in every movie or TV show was somehow put there by the government. So there's a kind of yawning chasm, if you like, between those two polar opposites. And into that came my work and the people I've worked with, some academics, some more independent media. And we've tried, and I in particular have tried, to kind of take the conspiracy theory version of popular culture seriously, but again, keep going back to the evidence, keep trying to draw out more evidence, in particular through Freedom of Information Act requests, and build a view of it and analysis of it from that.
Can you tell us a bit about your background and how you ended up going down this path of researching and studying the impact of clandestine agencies on society, including, but of course, by no means limited to, the entertainment media? Like, how did you get on to this particular path?
Well, good question. I mean, how far do you really want to go back with that, I suppose? I've always, from a kind of personal and cultural point of view, I've always been fascinated by political thrillers and spy thrillers and that kind of fiction, that kind of entertainment. That's always been a topic that's kind of fascinated me, both in its fictional and in its real forms. I've never been someone who particularly likes the government. I'm kind of an anarchist at heart. So naturally, that led me towards not necessarily conspiracy theories, but the kinds of criticisms that get made of government agencies, and in particular, the crimes that they commit. And when you look at it, a huge number of those crimes, at least from my perspective, seem to be committed by the very people who are there supposedly to try and stop crimes and to try and deal with them after they've happened. So, yeah, it kind of came out of that. But I guess there's also the fact that I was 18 years old when 9/11 happened. I watched it happen live on TV. It has certainly influenced my entire adult life to some extent, intellectually, psychologically, politically, the whole nine yards. So there's that. And then I suppose, it's a little difficult to know kind of how to tie it all together, really, because out of my interest, and obviously lots of other people did the same thing, my interest in 9/11 research, I got into the whole question of, well, what is this thing, Al-Qaeda, that we're supposed to be fighting? And then in the midst of me trying to figure that one out, the London bombings happened in 2005, and I spent several years looking into what happened there, looking at other people's research, reading everything there really was available to read on it. I made two video YouTube documentaries about that and wrote a book about that. And when I got to the end of that kind of period of research, or at least I'd done everything I felt I could do on that particular topic, that's where the spy culture thing came in. That was an interest I'd had for a long time. And in the course of investigating 7/7, I'd become a much better researcher. I'd become much more mature in my thinking and in my approach. I'd learned how to file Freedom of Information requests and search through National Archives in a very effective way. Stuff like that. So I took all that and folded it into let's try and research Hollywood in a really, grounded, document-based way. Does that answer the question, or?
Oh, yeah, pretty much. There was one thing, though, that I'm curious about that I've heard you kind of mention in passing on your podcast, but without a lot of detail, but I'm curious as to what your academic background is in terms of formal academia, as much as you want to share, just what do you study in university, that sort of thing. I'm just curious.
Oh, I have a BA in humanities, but it's a general, I studied all sorts of different things. I studied philosophy, history, history of art, history of film and TV, various different kinds of writing, literature, a whole bunch of different stuff. So essentially I'm not qualified to do anything except what I'm doing now. So
yeah. Well, I pretty much know the feeling. I've got up through a master's degree in history, and what else could I do but teach history and do a history podcast? I mean, I suppose I could be an above average, well-read stocker of the shelves of Walmart, but beyond that, this is kind of all I've got. Well, I want to start jumping into your work on this, national security cinema, as you put it. So there are these divisions within certain government agencies, such as, in particular, we're talking about the U.S. government, although it seems like there's versions of this in the U.K. as well. Within certain government agencies, there's these divisions known as Entertainment Liaison Offices, or ELOs, and they're in things like the Defense Department, the CIA, the FBI, etc. And these ELOs are not really secret, at least not these days. You can literally find basic info about them on government agencies' own websites. And yet, few among the general public seem to know a damn thing about them at all. And even fewer have any idea of the impact that these things have on popular entertainment, which is, I think you would probably agree, is a lot greater than the ELOs themselves tell the public. They kind of describe their role as being much more modest than it really is. But can you just describe a little bit about what the ELOs are and what they do and how they impact popular entertainment like Hollywood films?
Sure. I mean, all government agencies, or at least in sort of developed Western governments, that style of government, they all have some kind of office of public affairs. The thing that most of them didn't have until the 1990s was some kind of entertainment branch. Because normally public affairs means dealing with the press, right? Whereas this is something quite different. It requires different talents to be able to work with Hollywood than it does to be able to work with the Washington Post. So, I mean, the Pentagon and the FBI have had some version of this since before World War II, even. But the Pentagon very much formalized their setup after World War II. But I suppose, you know, that's when the Department of Defense was formally born. But from that moment onwards, they have had a film office, a film and TV liaison office. And now they have each different branch of the military has their own office. And they, on paper, they sit around waiting for requests from the entertainment industry to come in. And this could be a request to film at a military base or borrow some tanks or get a bunch of uniformed extras for a few scenes. Or it could just be research and technical advice for a documentary. All the different roles that you could imagine the military playing, or indeed an intelligence agency or another government agency, playing in the production of a documentary or a piece of entertainment fiction or whatever, that's what they do. And as they tell it, you know, these occasional requests come in and they, you know, liaise with the industry and try and help them out. In reality, they're actually quite proactive and aggressive at trying to get more entertainment producers, more writers, more directors, and so on, to work with them and to work on projects that conform to their values and their way of thinking. And the part of the process that really bothers me is that with the Pentagon, it's completely formalized. You have to give them 5 copies of your script or your story treatment or screenplay or whatever so that they can review it line by line and take out or change anything they don't like. And that can be a little bit of dialogue, it can be the name of a character, it can be a location, all sorts of stuff, a plot point. And if you don't agree to their terms, and if you don't agree to making changes that they demand, then you don't get access to whatever it is you want access to. So that actually puts the Pentagon in particular in an enormously powerful position to influence the entertainment that we're seeing on screen.
Yeah, and you've told a lot of specific stories, you know, the ones that you've been able to dig up, both in your book, National Security Cinema, co-written with, what's your co-author's name, Matthew Alford, is that correct?
Yeah, Matt Alford from Bath University, yeah.
Oh, okay. Great. And so you tell some specific stories in there, and you also, on your podcast, Clandestime, have told some of these specific stories. And it's incredible how much the Pentagon can really micromanage these things where, I mean, they're literally rewriting scripts. I don't think that, you know, more than 1 or 2% of the general public has any idea that the Pentagon's influence over Hollywood is that deep, where they're literally suggesting script ideas, forcing rewrites of scripts. Some of them are kind of amusing. It seems like the Pentagon is mostly just interested in every military person in a movie pretty much being portrayed as, you know, noble and selfless and all that sort of stuff. It seems like what the Pentagon does is kind of a bit simple in its overall goal.
Well, I mean, we don't know what their overall goals are, because according to Phil Strub, the DOD's main Hollywood liaison and the guy who has the ultimate say as to whether a project gets approved or not, he says their criteria are extremely broad and there is no fixed list of things that you can or can't have in a movie, and that it's all about context and it's all about what's the overall tone of this film or whatever. And so the kinds of changes they make range from everything from eliminating references to military suicide through to not portraying naval officers having romantic relationships together, and everything in between that you could conceive of has at some point been changed or in some way manipulated by the Pentagon. So, I mean, yeah, their mentality is primarily just they want to make the military look good. They want people to value the military. They want people to want to join the military and stay in the military. And that's more or less it. Whether they have any like overarching ideological or geopolitical aims with all of this? Actually, we don't know. I mean, we can extrapolate from the sorts of changes that they've made to these different products, but we would be extrapolating. It's not like I can actually show you any kind of strategy document or anything. We've not been able to get anything like that, and I'm not even 100% sure if it exists.
Yeah, so it might be sort of subjective, just Phil Strub and whoever else is kind of working with and for him, just sort of subjectively saying, oh, rewrite this, oh, rewrite that, you know, kind of could almost be sort of just ad hoc.
It's somewhat ad hoc, because like I say, they do treat, you can't approach a film that's about a court-martial drama, because someone in the military has done something wrong. You can't approach that film the same way as you approach Jurassic Park 3 or Transformers. And they work on all of these stuff. You can't approach Food Truck Face-Off in the same way as you approach a documentary about Afghanistan. So, yeah, I think it is kind of ad hoc. And in a way, that gives them an enormous amount of freedom. Although I would like to say, it's not the actual command structure is something we've been trying to nail down for years now, really. And it's not that easy. Because on paper, Phil Strub is in charge of all of this. But he himself has made references to the fact that everything he does has to get some kind of DoD approval. That it used to be, basically, a request would come in, he'd go to the whichever branch of the military it was, and say, okay, they want to film on this Air Force base, so you contact public affairs of that Air Force base and say, can you actually manage this? Are you free enough to do this at the moment? And that's how the whole process would work. And he's saying, in the more recent years, it's very much, well, is DoD on board with this? Has it got their approval? Are they okay with this? So who does he answer to exactly? And the way he tells it, it's kind of just him and these small satellite offices out in Los Angeles with a small number of staff. But yet there's numerous references, even on government websites themselves, to like public affairs staff for the Joint Chiefs working on entertainment products. So, well, they're not working directly for the entertainment liaison offices. So it kind of makes you wonder how many people in the military are actually involved in this process. Because the way Strub tells it, like I say, it's just him and a handful of staff at the Air Force and the Army and the other branches, and that's it. But it clearly isn't.
Yeah, and like you said, it would be really interesting to find out kind of for most film projects, how far up the chain of the DoD's command does he have to go? Is the Secretary of Defense literally being, consulted on, hey, what about this script? What about this movie? Seems like probably not, at least not on a routine basis, but, how far is it? Some assistant Secretary of Defense somewhere who's getting, copied on all this stuff and is telling Phil Strub either yes or no. I mean, would be amazing to turn up any records of how that exactly works.
Well, we do know from some of the Entertainment Liaison Office reports, which are kind of weekly or every bi-weekly diaries of some kind of what they've been up to, that this does involve people like the Secretary of the Army. The Army's office reports say, the Secretary of the Army is actually quite involved with this. And I think it was their suggestion that the Army seek out the Science and Entertainment Exchange and get involved with them. And this is another kind of entertainment liaison office in Hollywood who primarily provide scientific advice and consultants to movies. But they're very good at outreach. They're very good at, schmoozing with Hollywood bigwigs. So that's what the Army seem to now be using them for or getting help from them about. So this does involve some very senior people. We know that much.
Yeah, some of the specific cases that you've been able to uncover of actual rewrites where, one way or another, either through getting access to a document or from someone kind of, in an interview or in director's commentary or something talking about it. Some of these are kind of amusing, like how they, I think there was one case, I can't remember if it was on your podcast or in your book, or maybe it was in both, the case of, I think it was Godzilla, the recent Godzilla movie, which, I had enough sense to not bother to go see. From what I understand, it was not a particularly good movie, but I guess there was a character in there who was, you know, an army soldier or something, and was kind of a scumbag, and then they basically, I think someone from the DOD even, like, kind of rewrote it themselves and made the character, like, this really cardboard cutout, boring kind of, you know, G.I. Joe stereotype. And I don't know, these stories, they just amuse the hell out of me, because not only is it, you know, blatantly using these films for propaganda purposes, but in a lot of cases, as you've pointed out, it results in a much less interesting movie with much less interesting characters. If everybody is this kind of cardboard cutout, you know, perfect noble soldier and sailor and everything like that, I mean, the movie's not even terribly interesting.
Well, no. I mean, where does drama come from if not have people having character flaws?
Right. Yeah, you can't have everybody in a military uniform be like a Marty Stew or something.
No, sure. And lots of people objected to that about that Godzilla movie. I mean, I didn't pay to see it, but I have seen it. And it's okay as a monster movie, but it does really lack human drama. At the center of it is this Navy EOD tech. You know, he disarms bombs, basically. And he's boring. He's really boring. Just completely middle of the road, bland, wife and kid. Nothing really about him. He kind of has an absence of character, almost, at the heart of this movie. And lots of people complained about this and said, you know, it was otherwise a moderately entertaining film, but just the human element, the characters just were bland and boring as hell. And yeah, it turns out one of the reasons for this is that in an earlier draft of the script, the Pentagon saw, he had some kind of problem with his wife. He was a bit of a schemer and a liar. And they said, oh, no, you can't portray a Navy tech like that. No, we're not having that. We're not having our naval officers portrayed like that. You need to take out all of that, strip it all out. He said that, you know, they went to the writers and said, well, what are you getting out of this negative character? And according to Strub, they couldn't really explain it. So he said, oh, well, you know, just strip it all out then. And what's left? Not an awful lot. A man who does some stuff, kind of.
Yeah, that's it. It's funny that the writers, if his telling of the exchange is correct, that the writers couldn't have even answered and said, well, characters with flaws are interesting, you know, and that's why this guy has some issues and some problems and whatever. It just really makes you wonder about how many Hollywood scriptwriters even understand, you know, their own trade in theory.
Oh, I think quite a lot of them don't, particularly if they're working on a film like that that's so big budget and CGI heavy. They know they're ultimately making a film about a guy who's chasing a giant CGI Godzilla. So does it really matter if he's interesting or not? I mean, that film still made a profit anyway. But I guess the point is, they probably could have made more money if they'd actually had something other than just a giant monster in the film. I mean, if it had a, you know, a plot and characters that resonated with the audience and that they cared about and that they wanted to know what was going to happen next with them, it would have been a more successful film. It would have been a better film. And just purely on an entertainment basis, it would have been a better movie. So, yeah, you do wonder if that bit of dialogue, if that kind of conversation that Strub remembers did actually go that way. You think, these writers should have been able to come up with something better than that. They should have been able to explain to him, look, if it's just 2 hours of a boring guy chasing Godzilla, that's not going to make for a great movie. So there has to be some kind of tension between him and his wife. He has to be a guy who maybe starts out as a bit of a schemer and a liar and through this process learns to be a better man or something. You know, that's what the essence of drama is. I can't believe they didn't say that to him, but maybe they didn't. Maybe they're just some foolish screenwriters who were working on a crappy Godzilla movie.
Yeah, and, you know, looking at just Hollywood movies in general, not just the ones where there's military and intelligence involvement, but just overall at kind of mainstream blockbuster type Hollywood movies, that seems to be a common flaw just in movies in general in modern times, where very often the characters are not interesting at all. I mean, I think on Star Wars Rogue One, The only character that seemed interesting at all was the autistic robot.
Yep, he's really funny, the robot. Everyone else in the film is pretty dull and a bit depressing. and as a result, okay, you've got this nice-looking space adventure, but by the end of the film, who cares?
Right, and it's a movie where, plot spoiler, all the quote-unquote good guys pretty much die at the end, which could be a movie with a huge emotional impact, but since we barely know anything about any of these characters and none of them seem to have any real personality, then we don't really give that much of a crap at all when they all die.
No. I mean, I'd argue even The Force Awakens suffers somewhat from that. The character of Rey, like a lot of female action stars, is kind of bland and flawless.
Yeah, she's a Mary Sue for sure.
It's quite entertaining to watch because Daisy Ridley put a lot into that performance, but the character itself is pretty underwritten and, like you say, a bit of a Mary Sue, and it's kind of like, well, okay, but wouldn't it be more fun if she has some flaws to try and learn to overcome throughout the course of this struggle? Isn't that kind of what Star Wars was always about, was these young, imperfect people going on this massive adventure and learning about themselves? And that's kind of the point of the story in a lot of ways. That's why we like Luke, Han, and Leia.
Yeah, this is, you know, hero's journey in archetypes 101, right? That the hero has to screw up a bit and be imperfect, and that's kind of what, you know, makes the hero's journey interesting.
Well, I'm sympathetic. It's not like we're sitting there thinking, oh, we could never do any of that because we're not perfect. We're sat there thinking, yeah, I can kind of see a bit of myself in this character, and maybe there's a bit of a lesson in here for me too. That's kind of the best thing you can do in a movie, or at least a adventure-driven movie. And yet, modern entertainment, I think, again, it's partly to do with the CGI thing, because now you can make such beautiful-looking settings, you can build a world so easily with CGI, that they're so focused on the setting of the film, or the big monster or whatever, that they forget that ultimately it's about the people in it. You can build the most fascinating sci-fi futurism whatever that you want, but if the people in it are bland and dull and uninteresting and unsympathetic, then no one will care.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more with that. You've mentioned how the major American state security apparatus players in influencing media entertainment, the CIA, the FBI, the military itself, you know, the Department of Defense, and then starting, I guess, a little bit more recently, the NSA, that, again, like you said, you know, you're not privy to all the inside goings on, and so can't say for sure exactly what's going on, but just seems like, you know, just judging on what you have been able to get your hands on as far as documents and just sort of observing the pattern of what we know about these agencies intervening in filmmaking, that they seem to have kind of different personalities. And my understanding of it is that it seems like the military and the FBI, again, from what we can tell, have a little bit more of a simplistic view, where it's basically like, you know, we want the military to always be put in a good light, or we want the FBI to always be put in a good light. But it seems like the CIA and perhaps the NSA as well, they have kind of a more ambiguous or sophisticated strategy of what they're doing. Because it seems like the CIA and NSA are a little bit more comfortable with things like having themselves sometimes portrayed in what you might consider a morally ambiguous way, or a morally problematic way even. So what's your take on these differences and what they might mean?
Well, it's hard to know, because, I mean, one of the problems is that you're comparing the military and the FBI, who had some kind of liaison office for basically a century at this point, with the CIA, who only formally set up an office in the 1990s. So you do have this difference between the military, who had an ability to influence the war movie from its very inception, from, you know, the earliest big war movies all had Pentagon support. So therefore, what constitutes a war movie, and the values and morality and so on that's portrayed in those films is quite well established by this government agency for a long, long time. Whereas by the time the CIA arrived on the scene, there'd already been three decades of movies portraying them pretty badly. So they had to maybe work with what they had. But one of the interesting things that we found was that there is some evidence, not conclusive, that the CIA actually worked on 3 Days of the Condor, which is widely believed to be one of the most critical movies about the CIA ever made. And in my opinion, is. I mean, it's a fantastic film. Not just for that reason, but, you know. But if the CIA supported that, and supported that portrayal of themselves, you have to wonder, what is it that they're trying to accomplish? Because it clearly isn't just positive PR for themselves. It's clearly something more complex than that. And I think, because I get this, asked this question quite a lot, if you go back to the 1950s, right, what we know what the CIA were up to is their influence on cinema wasn't really about their own public image, because they prevented filmmakers and TV producers from portraying the CIA at all until 1959. So for the first over a decade of their existence, there was no cinema about the CIA. So what were they doing in Hollywood? Well, they were doing things like altering dialogue concerning, in particular, female characters and black characters in movies, because they wanted to portray America as a more racially harmonious and more what we might call now politically correct society than it really was. And certainly than it really was at that point in time, because you still had the Jim Crow laws then. But they wanted to portray it in that way, not just to Americans, but primarily they were thinking to foreign audiences. They wanted to project this image of America as a great society and a great country. So this isn't really about the CIA at all. It's about a more general worldview that they were actually trying to influence through cinema. And this is something that even the OSS, the predecessor to the CIA, even they discussed doing this. So I think they've had greater ambitions than just their own public image for a long, long time. And yeah, they support, when we actually kind of broke it down for ourselves, we thought, well, of all the movies that the CIA has supported that actually portray the CIA, most of them portray the CIA quite badly. It's only really Argo and the Mission Impossible films that you could say portray them well. And in the case of Mission Impossible, it's not really the CIA. It's the IMF, the Impossible Mission Force, who we guess are supposed to be some kind of metaphor for the CIA. But yeah, okay, they're pretty good. They don't tend to go around torturing and killing people very much. So aside from that, most of the other ones, I mean, Meet the Parents and Meet the Fockers, the only CIA character in those films is this kind of paranoid control freak dad who's kind of got his entire family under his thumb. He's not all that sympathetic. But I mean, is that how the CIA want to be portrayed? I don't know. If you look at Good Shepherd, the one that's kind of a quasi-docudrama about the history of the CIA, they come across as a bunch of torturing, murderous fanatics.
yeah. But that one even brings in some Skull and Bones stuff.
Yeah.
Not very flattering.
No, it's not. And when you read what the CIA's own like in-house academic publication, what they had to say about The Good Shepherd, they were kind of crapping on the movie throughout the whole review. And then at the end of it, turned around and said, yeah, but it's still better than most films that you would ever see about the CIA. So clearly they were moderately happy with it, at least. And the way the logic that I use to explain this, and I'm not sure if this is how they think about it, but once again, extrapolating from what we know, is that for the CIA, they know they're never going to be accepted as, in the public mind, as being as heroic as the military. People just aren't going to think of spies in the same way. So their approach is, well, okay, if people are going to think of us as kind of sneaky and devious and capable of acting outside the law, why not try and turn that to our advantage and say, yeah, but the world is such a dark, chaotic, dangerous place that aren't you in fact glad you've got some psychotic hard bastards on your side who are willing to do these things? And that's kind of the cinematic consensus about the CIA at this point is that, yeah, they do evil things, they do illegal things, but it's all necessary because the world is so horrible. And so once again, it's about your, not just the CIA themselves, but about your general worldview that is being influenced through these entertainment products by this secretive government agency.
Yeah, and it also raises the question, how much of the CIA or any other agency, when they sort of cultivate this morally ambiguous image of themselves, how much of it is also for intimidation purposes, whether foreign or domestic, you know, to kind of, for people who are maybe a little bit more in the conspiracy-minded realm, they'll watch a movie about the CIA doing some nasty things and perhaps be, you know, intimidated and kind of like, oh no, I'm scared of the CIA or whoever it is, the NSA, for example. So there's this potential intimidation propaganda going on.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it's one of the number one things that my friends and family who not kind of opposed to what I'm doing, but I made maybe a little uneasy by it. They were always sort of telling me, oh, you know, you're going to end up on some list somewhere. You're going to end up sort of being spied on by these agencies. And I'm thinking, so? let them, I guess. I mean, I can't stop them, so I'm not going to let that stop me. But they're getting this impression, obviously, from entertainment. This notion that, oh, you know, every random blogger on the internet who says something about the CIA is going to get spied on. I mean, maybe they are, don't get me wrong. I'm just saying that kind of somewhat paranoid mentality actually seems to come from these films, many of which have been supported by these intelligence agencies anyway. And I kind of find all that rather ironic. But yeah, you're absolutely right. There is some kind of strategy of intimidation going on here. And this goes back to Tom Clancy, or at least as far as Tom Clancy, who rather notoriously, when he was accused of essentially leaking classified information in his novels, which he may or may not have done. I'm not 100% sure where I stand on that question, but he was accused of it repeatedly. And one of his responses was, you want the enemy to know some of this stuff. Not everything, of course. You have to take an intelligent approach to it. But he even said this at one of his presentations at the NSA, which you can watch on YouTube. He said, you want to not necessarily leak, but portray some of your technological capabilities and your other capabilities because you want your enemy to know what you're able to do to them if necessary, because that will intimidate them and it will put them off from doing things that they would otherwise do. And so whether you consider the enemies foreign or domestic, I don't know if it makes a huge amount of difference, but yeah, fast forwarding from Tom Clancy in the 80s to the CIA's first Hollywood liaison, Chase Brandon, he quite notoriously said to the producer of The Agency, which was a very heavily CIA-supported TV drama, he said to the producer that he wanted him to put in this some kind of biometric technology that the CIA didn't actually have, because the producer turned around and said, come on, do you actually have things that can do that? And he said, no, but we want it to be in there because terrorists watch TV too. And I guess he's not wrong, but it kind of makes you wonder, right? So you're putting a fictional technology into a TV show in order to scare 0.0001% of the people watching. That's the kind of propaganda objectives and mentality you have. That's kind of, it's kind of hilarious and terrifying at the same time, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. You know, if I'm remembering right, one movie I was at first surprised, but then when I kind of thought about this line of reasoning that we've been on right here, that the CIA perhaps in some indirect way supported, was the film Kill the Messenger, which I rather liked the movie. And, you know, I've found the Gary Webb story very interesting for a long time. And if I remember right, I think in national security cinema, you had basically categorized Kill the Messenger as it had ex-CIA member involvement of some sort or another, but not, you know, direct overt CIA itself involvement. But, you know, who knows what all that actually means. But
well, we're not sure. I'm not sure still now. I mean, I've seen the film several times. I've researched the angles that it's possible to research on that one. And yeah, there was a former CIA agent who worked as some kind of consultant on the script. But there is also other things like there is a shot of Langley in the movie. There is the CIA seal portrayed quite in, you know, the real CIA seal. There's a few other little telltale signs that appear in other movies that we know had CIA support. So we're left wondering. And when you look at some of the people who worked on it, these are people who'd previously worked on TV and films that had CIA support. So all of the usual telltale signs are there. But nonetheless, we don't have any kind of smoking gun proving they were involved. And like you say, when you watch the film, you think, well, it's certainly not a pro-CIA.
Yeah, although may have some utility, like we've been saying, in the realm of intimidation and, you know, making the CIA look really dangerous and badass and that sort of thing.
Well, it does tell a story of one of the few journalists who've seriously gone up against the CIA and the tragedy that then happened to him. So, like you say, it could be a form of psychological intimidation, this one aimed primarily at journalists. Or it could be that they never, it could simply be that the producers went to them for very, very small, limited amount of support, like permission to use film of Langley and permission to use CIA logo and stuff. And they looked at it and thought, yeah, that's a useful angle for us. And the CIA themselves are portrayed very, very briefly in the film. And the campaign against Gary Webb, it isn't really implied that they were behind it. It implies that they encouraged it, or at least supported it in some way, but not that they were, you know, directing this themselves. And I know there is some dispute over this, historically, as to quite how involved the CIA were in the backlash against Gary Webb. So I can see an angle for them. I can see a couple of angles for them. So even a film like that, which is a great piece of cinema, in my opinion, it's one of the kind of forgotten classics of recent American films, even that one may well have been for these reasons that we're now discussing.
Yeah, it seems like it also, that film and maybe a few others that also portray the CIA in sort of a similar light also might potentially be a limited hangout sort of a thing where, you know, the Gary Webb story is somewhat notorious in a lot of circles. And so, you know, the CIA might have been willing to be involved with the film from a limited hangout sort of strategy where they're like, well, you know, this thing is kind of out there. So let's see if we can at least exercise some degree of influence or control over exactly how it's portrayed and exactly how much information comes through.
Yes. Yes. I mean, that's the thing. The cat is out of the bag as far as the CIA and drug trafficking goes. And it does seem that they have supported a number of productions, and even beyond just the CIA, there are an increasing number of productions willing to look at that storyline, at that notion of, are there CIA or military intelligence people actually deeply involved in the drugs trade? And, I mean, another recent example is the series Shooter, where in the second season, there is actually quite a complex CIA-involved drug trafficking conspiracy in Afghanistan. And that's in the war in Afghanistan, you know, in the recent past, not sort of going back to Vietnam or anything. So it seems that's a topic you can now discuss, even in state-sponsored media. But I guess you have to discuss it within certain confines, or, as I was saying before, in the context of a world that is so kind of chaotic and full of psychotic criminals, that aren't you glad that we've got a few of these psychotic criminals on our side?
Yeah, a couple more that spring to my mind in this kind of realm. One is the film American Made about Barry Seal. And the other is the Netflix Punisher series, which also had, you know, some CIA drug connection type stuff in it. And in watching both of those, both of which I enjoyed, I was wondering, because of course, you know, like I said, over the last year or so, I've been following your work, and I was wondering, watching both of those, you know, how much, if any, CIA involvement is there in these films, and, you know, to what end? What's the angle? What's the strategy? And it's very hard to figure out.
Well, it is very hard to figure out. The CIA don't release a lot of documents, and in a lot of these cases, I'm having to kind of, like I say, go on telltale signs or little bits that have come out in media interviews or something. Or sometimes it gets revealed in a director's commentary when the DVD finally comes out, stuff like that.
Right.
I don't know about the Punisher series. I've not. Oh, go on.
Oh, I was just going to say that was the next thing I wanted to ask you about, because, you know, a lot of your research methods are very interesting, and you kind of like reverse engineer things almost, or I guess it's almost sort of like a form of forensics. So, like we've said, you know, it's very tricky getting accurate information about these sorts of things where it's some of the most, you know, secretive parts of the state apparatus. So can you just sort of tell us a bit about your research methodologies?
I guess it's like any serious investigation into the real world. You basically have to follow the thread. You have to look at what information is available. So first, that just involves a lot of, you know, using of search engines, looking around for interviews with producers and other people involved in the entertainment industry who actually will talk about this. I mean, like the showrunner of Homeland has revealed some astonishing things. And I mean, most recently, right? This is a slight tangent from your question, but I'm going to go on about this anyway. Alex Ganser, who has been running Homeland ever since the first season, in fact was previously a producer on 24, which was also CIA supported, he recently said that he was describing how before every season they have these meetings in Georgetown that are set up by a very senior former CIA officer, and they talk to CIA, State Department, journalists, White House people, all sorts, to try and get ideas and a feel for, you know, what people are anticipating so that they can make their series as kind of on the button as they possibly can. And he said that in previous seasons, they've had to keep the intelligence people and the journalists separate because there is some kind of antagonism between them. But he said, but this year, there was none of that, and that they were actually very chummy, and that this is all about some kind of CIA program to work with the New York Times and the Washington Post to combat, as he put it, a non-fact-based presidency. So he's basically admitting, bear in mind this is a TV producer, he's admitting in a like an interview with Variety or someone that the CIA is conspiring against the presidency using major newspapers. And now, no matter what you think of Trump, and it's probably exactly the same as what I think of Trump, that's still illegal. They're still not supposed to be doing that. And we shouldn't really be finding out about this from Hollywood producers. I mean, what world are we living in? Isn't this something that should be coming out in a congressional inquiry? You know what I mean? rather than Alex Ganser blurting his mouth at Variety. So, I mean, it's stuff like that. It's lots of freedom of information requests. And with the CIA, especially, ever since they put the CREST database online, I've been going through that and trying to mine that for all the information I can get about their roles with, you know, their involvement with fiction writers and screenwriters and so on. All of that's historical. I mean, the CREST database only goes up to like the early 90s. But still, there's been quite a lot of useful stuff that come out of that. The Pentagon have been resistant, but they ultimately have released a lot of information to me and are continuing to release information to me. And we're going to do a second edition of the book next year, hopefully, that's going to incorporate all of this. Also, just a lot of searching around on IMDb a lot of the time. You find a military location and you think, oh, well, who else has filmed at this military location? And that maybe adds another couple of TV shows and films to your increasingly large database of how many products the DOD has supported over the years. Whenever you find out about people who used to work for the entertainment liaison offices and have now set up some kind of private consultancy in Hollywood, I take that name, I put it through all the search engines, I try and find out as much as possible about them, I try and find out as much as possible about the other projects they've worked on. So it's kind of a scavenger hunt, but at the same time, it's a attacking the subject from several different angles at once and using lots of different sources of information to try and get a nice big rounded picture of all this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, one of the things that really cracked me up in a weird sort of way that I came across in National Security Cinema was the bit about this guy, Lawrence Swid or Swede or Sued, or I don't know how you say it. This guy.
Sued?
Yeah, I guess so. This guy who got tons of documents about the DOD Hollywood relationship from the 70s to 2005. And then he like hoards these things all to himself. It's just such a bizarre, this is such a bizarre situation. Can you tell us a little bit about this guy and what the deal is with all the stuff he's hoarding?
Sure, sure. I mean, he's an academic at Georgetown, and he, as far as we know, essentially rescued this stuff that the DOD's film office was just going to chuck this stuff out, or at least the first batch that he got, I think, back in the 70s. This was stuff going from maybe even the late 40s through to the 70s. They were kind of going to throw this out, and he apparently rescued it. And since then, they've released periodically batches of new stuff from the entertainment liaison offices, going all the way, I mean, at least to the late 90s, and we think the early 2000s in some cases as well. And he's written several books, very encyclopedic, very informative, very useful reference books in lots of ways, but ones that are completely uncritical of the DOD's involvement and influence over scripts. And he seems to have a lot of the same records that we now have, at least some of them. And so he should know about this. He should know about the politically motivated changes to Hollywood scripts that the DOD has been involved in for decades. And yet he doesn't write about that side of things, or he seems to, for whatever reason, he just doesn't seem to think it's an issue of any controversy or any real importance. And so we have tried various different times, and other colleagues and friends of ours have tried to get access to this information. And every single time, he's come up with some kind of reason or rationale or excuse for why that can't happen, including saying that until he's finished with this research archive and has finished publishing on it, he doesn't want to release it publicly. Which you could argue, as a private researcher, he is somewhat entitled to do, but the counter-argument to that is, yeah, but these are government documents. These aren't things that you kind of put together yourself. These should just be publicly available information, for heaven's sake. In fact, it should all be in the National Archives. So, he is problematic. However, it now emerges, since we published the book, those archives now seem to have become open and available. And in fact, Matt is planning a visit fairly soon, actually, I think in the next couple of months, to go and have a go through that archive and see what information is in there. Because as far as we know, no one's had any access to it since David Robb, his book Operation Hollywood, which is nearly 15 years ago now. So who knows whether there was stuff Rob missed? Is there stuff that he never got to see? And so on. So we're going to try and get the information that is there and, like I say, fold that into the second edition. But you have to wonder, by the time that we've been able to get access to it, most of it's at least 20 years out of date. So from a kind of newsworthiness point of view, it's old news, it's old info. We doubt that there's going to be much in there that's going to grab very many headlines. Nonetheless, it's going to flesh out the picture of just how much influence the DOD can have on these sorts of movies. So it's certainly going to be useful to us, but we are kind of wondering, well, Lawrence Seward hasn't published a book since 2005. Why didn't he just make it all available then?
Yeah, I'll definitely be interested to see if anything, you know, major comes out of those things being open, because it's just such a weird situation that this guy stashes these things, and I think you said it's at a public library, but it's like in a private, you know,
archive.
Yeah, locked up situation that people can't access. It just sounds so strange, but overall, looking at the work you've done on this sort of stuff, what would you say are some of the more interesting and or troubling things that you've discovered, the things that, you know, even for a guy like you, who I'm assuming pretty cynical when you're dealing with like the state and the entertainment industry, that nonetheless, the things that like really kind of grabbed you and surprised even you.
I mean, I guess there's, I mean, some of these, I was surprised to find out that the CIA worked on Meet the Parents and Meet the Fockers, because they're, I mean, they're quite good movies. Don't get me wrong. I quite enjoyed both of them, but I just never would have, until I got deeply into this, I never would have conceived of them as being some kind of PR or propaganda vehicles for the agency. Likewise, I never would have thought that the DOD would be involved in a movie like Contact. You remember Contact? 1990s film, sort of sci-fi epic? Because that's really quite a philosophical movie in a lot of ways. It has this undercurrent of the conflict between religion and science that's reconciled by the end of the film when the two main characters, one a religious figure, one a scientist, realize that they're actually very similar and that in fact their beliefs have a lot in common. And in particular, the positive elements of their beliefs have a lot in common. And so that's a quite unusual thing for a Hollywood movie to do. And so, yeah, I was surprised to find out that the DOD were supported that and that they, in fact, compromised some of the philosophical elements of that film. Because when I first saw it, I was genuinely very impressed by, I mean, for a film, let's face it, this isn't a, you know, 500-word book, page book. So you've got to accept what it's possible to do with a film philosophically. I thought they were quite ambitious and did very well. And so I was quite surprised and dismayed to find out that the Pentagon had got in there and ripped out a few things that they didn't like about it that actually ended up compromising the movie. I mean, there's lots of examples. It's the thing that strikes me just in general terms that's so bizarre is that we don't really make war films very often anymore. When you look at the 50s, 60s, even into the 70s and 80s, a lot of war movies got made. But in particular, post-Vietnam and now into this increasingly unpopular war on terror, Hollywood doesn't make that many movies set in these wars, and the ones that are, generally speaking, aren't supported by the military. And instead, they're helping to make movies like Battleship and Transformers and Godzilla and just, you know, schlock. I mean, very expensive, very profitable schlock, but nonetheless, schlock that doesn't really have an awful lot to do with the military or the real world. And you kind of wonder, you know, what's in it for them to work on Hulk or Battleship? I mean, I guess it's aimed at the sort of audience that they're recruiting from, young men, primarily. I guess that's the thinking behind it. But from a kind of PR point of view, it's sort of weird to try and say, oh, we're concerned with accuracy and realism in the military portrayals in movies, and that's why we had our fighter jets battling with a, you know, 150-foot giant alien robot.
Yeah.
What world is Phil Strub living on, honestly?
Right, yeah, those are some ones that kind of surprised me. You know, the Transformers films, the Godzilla films. And boy, have they been involved in a lot of the superhero films. And I think you've said that basically, you know, from what you've been able to put together, they more or less rewrote the first Iron Man movie.
Again, we're extrapolating because we couldn't get proper full documentation on this, and I don't think that documentation even exists anymore. So, but what we did figure out is that if you compare where the first Iron Man film was in pre-production and where that film ended up, you start out with a very anti-war film and a very anti-military industrial complex movie where the central character Tony Stark is refusing to work at his father's weapons manufacturing industry and eventually goes to war with his father and another major weapons manufacturer using the Iron Man suit. By comparison to the 2008 film, Iron Man is essentially a symbol of the military industrial complex. He is flying into Afghanistan and laying waste to faceless brown terrorists, just like military does in, you know, Black Hawk Down, or, you know, take your pick of movies. So the change in the scope, the philosophy, the politics of that film was enormous. And we can only assume that the Pentagon's support for it is one of the major reasons for that change. Because, yeah, I mean, you can find this draft script of the film knocking around online. And when I was reading that, that was quite a shock. There's even things where, like, Tony Stark is saying things like, weapons never make the world any more peaceful or safe. That's a line from the original script. In the final film, it's Tony saying, I have doubts about weapons being in some people's hands, but maybe this weapon, the Iron Man suit, in my hands it can do some good. Well, that's a reversal of the entire thinking behind that character and his role in the movie. On the one hand, he's saying, basically, these weapons of destruction are just going to wage more war and destruction and horror and death on the world. And in the other, he's saying, oh no, it matters whose hands they're in. It's got to be the good guys that have the weapons. And if the good guys have the weapons, everything will be okay. Well, isn't that ultimately, like I say, a pro-military and pro-military industrial complex message?
Yeah, absolutely. Are there any particular movies or television shows that come to mind for you where you, in your research, perhaps discovered that there was not any detectable military or intelligence involvement in making a particular production, where you were surprised at that, where you were like, holy cow, if anything, I would have guessed that that particular show or that particular movie would have been, you know, up to its eyeballs in direct, you know, national security state involvement.
One that springs to mind is American Sniper, which a lot of people suspected was like some kind of DOD propaganda movie. And it turns out, no, Bill Scrub rejected it. This is only a document I got quite recently. It came out of a bunch of Navy reports. But yeah, they were approached. They said, you know, we want to have full, you know, Clint Eastwood wanted full military support for this movie. And they looked at it and thought, this doesn't make us look good, essentially. That this character is not the symbol of the military that we want out there. So they said, no, it's not happening. They didn't even go through the script review process and said, you know, you need to change this, that, and the other. And there was some kind of, you know, disagreement or anything. I think he just looked at it and said, no, there's just no way. And a lot of people thought, you know, serious commentators thought that this was some kind of DOD supported film, and it just wasn't. And I was a little surprised by that.
Yeah. Yeah. I was too. And, you know, it's funny that they would have turned it down and said, oh, it doesn't make us look good, because, you know, I'm a guy who has lived my whole life in the American South, and I teach college history. So I'm around, you know, lots of young men who either are veterans or who are, you know, looking to join the military and that sort of thing in kind of a fairly working class town in the American South. And I get the impression that they didn't see American Sniper at all as a film that makes the military look bad. I get the impression that, you know, the types of guys who are in my classes, if anything, that movie and a movie like that in general makes them more amenable to joining the military.
Well, that's one of the curious things about that film, is that it does leave itself open to quite a lot of different interpretations. A lot of different people have seen different things in that film. Because I kind of hate it, to be honest. I sort of hate it. Well, fair enough. But, I mean, I found the central character just kind of loathsome. I can see why, from a Phil Strub kind of point of view, why they wouldn't support it. And you've also got to think, bear in mind, maybe, it's not just the audiences they're concerned with, it's also the media responses. And if you think about the underlying politics of most Hollywood critics versus the underlying politics of the sorts of guys that you're talking about, they're quite different, let's say, without chiseling down any further into that. And I'm sure by this point, we know from their own reports, they keep quite a close eye on the Hollywood press and on the critical and, you know, audience responses to these projects they work on. And so maybe they looked at that and they thought, this is going to get hammered by some reviewers. So we don't want a big credit at the end of the film thanking the DOD for supporting it, just in case anyone notices that. So I think it was maybe more that kind of line of thinking that led them to reject it rather than what you're saying, because, yeah, quite a lot of people saw that and saw it as a kind of heroic military film, and they wanted to be that guy. So maybe it actually worked as a military recruitment vehicle even without the military support for it.
Yeah, and it seems to me like that's a really important thing, is the degree to which, you know, movies are interpreted so differently, as are any other form of art or communication. You know, the subjective view of the viewer, where very often movies that perhaps were even made intentionally on the part of some of the people involved with their production to be kind of an anti-war overall statement, like, look how horrible war is. But then very often, kind of average Joe audiences, especially if they're, you know, young men from sort of a, you know, nationalistic background in the States, where they'll go see a movie that was at least on some level intended to be kind of a critical exposure of the horrors of war. They'll go see it and end up, you know, thinking, oh, that's great. You know, I'm more pro-war than ever. In fact, I might even join up. And some of the films that spring to my mind are things like Full Metal Jacket or Apocalypse Now or even Black Hawk Down, where on some level, according to, you know, some of the key people involved in making those films, those were intended to be more or less anti-war films. But, man, that's not how lots of young men in America are interpreting them at all.
No, I mean, well, I only watched Black Hawk Down quite recently, and I mean, I thought it was a very impressive movie. It's actually one of the better war films that I've seen in my life. It certainly didn't make me want to join the military. I mean, that film looks like hell on earth. But I guess to a certain sort of particularly young man, but not necessarily, some of that could actually seem quite exciting. Like, you know, you'd almost want to be, I don't know why you'd want to be in that situation, but, you know, some men are kind of drawn to the chaos and drawn to the conflict, I guess. Otherwise, we wouldn't even have militaries. I mean, who would you recruit? So, yeah. And then that is one that was supported by the DOD after some script changes were made to it. But, no, I know what you mean about Full Metal Jacket. That's another one that, I mean, according to different documents, it was either rejected or they never actually approached the military, probably because they realized there's no way they're going to support this one. But that's one that resonates with a lot of people. Apocalypse Now is one of those, like, you know, if you talk to certainly kind of macho type men, top favorite, you know, 10 favorite movies, quite a lot of them will mention Apocalypse Now. And yet the military hated it. They said there's no way, even when the producers went to the president, they went to Jimmy Carter and said, please, please, will you intervene and encourage the military to help us make this film? Because otherwise we're going to have to go and spend three times the amount of money shooting it in the Philippines or wherever. They still said no. They said, no dice. We're not helping make this film. And as a result, they, you know, the story of the making of Apocalypse Now is one of those incredible tales in terms of filmmaking where everything went wrong. You know, the main character had a heart attack. They had no end of storms. They had people in the crew getting struck down with all kinds of horrible tropical fevers. It was a total mess. And one of the main reasons for that is that the military said, no, we're not lending you a damn thing. We're not supporting this film about a military officer who goes to murder another military officer because he's gone rogue. And so, yeah, there is this curious thing, in particular with movies, where you notice just how divergent the opinions on these things really are. And so it does make you wonder, how does the military assess all of this? And is it even possible to assess this kind of thing as to how effective this all is? It's quite difficult to say.
Yeah, it does seem like it would be very difficult to make a war movie that couldn't at least potentially be interpreted, especially by, you know, a teenage male with more testosterone than sense who's been raised in an extremely nationalistic, you know, household and family and everything, and in a very nationalistic culture, and who's been inculcated with this since he was a toddler, and who, you know, probably has also been playing first-person shooter video games and Call of Duty and all these sorts of things. Like, that sort of young man, it seems like it would be hard to make any sort of war movie that couldn't potentially be interpreted as, hey, look, isn't this really, you know, alluring and sexy and badass and awesome?
Well, like we were saying before about Godzilla, this is one of the problems, isn't it? Is that if you make the characters bland and perfect, do people really want to be like them? Do they really identify with characters like that? No, they identify with the ones who are a bit imperfect and flawed and rough around the edges. And so actually a film that portrays the military more realistically, i.e. with flawed people, is in some ways more attractive to at least some audiences than these, you know, stripped down, tedious, empty, soulless characters that you get in the Pentagon's war movies these days. So, yeah. I mean, in some ways, it's more dramatic. It's more interesting. And in particular, in Full Metal Jacket, there's a great range of characters in there. No matter what sort of young man you are, you'll identify with someone in that film. Obviously, I was kind of identifying with Private Joker and his kind of rather whimsical and cynical approach to all of this.
Sure.
But other people are going to identify with, you know, Animal Mother or one of the other, you know, even Gomer Pyle, maybe, even the drill sergeant. He's a very striking character, but some people would look at him and actually have quite a lot of respect and admiration for someone with that degree of control and discipline.
Yeah, so, well, he's funny, too. That's the other thing, is he's often hilarious. He's
very, very funny. Horribly funny when what he's actually doing to these young men. But
Yeah, well, you know, this to me is really important stuff. And again, you know, just from my perspective, the effect that this often state-influenced entertainment seems to have on society in general in the U.S., and particularly on young men from the demographic groups who are most likely to go into the military or into intelligence or into law enforcement even, that these things are hugely powerful. I mean, I've talked to so many veterans of recent wars and also a fair number from Vietnam War and things like this, and it's amazing how often they will, when you start trying to dig into, you know, what really kind of made them join the military, it's very rare to come across someone who doesn't mention some amount of movie and or TV influence, where they're like, well, you know, I saw these war movies when I was a teenager and I was like, all right, you know, it's that's for me, that's really cool and sexy and exciting. And especially when, you know, so many Americans, and I'm sure it's the same in other countries for their own particular nationalism, but, you know, people are just inculcated into this nationalistic ideology. And ever since I started to learn real history and to really understand some of the facts about the kind of darker aspects of the state and started to kind of shed the statism and the nationalism in which I'd been pretty much inculcated with from childhood, it really made it difficult for me to watch a lot of standard mainstream movies about, you know, wars or spies or even law enforcement. So much of it is just propaganda. And even before I started, you know, delving into your work and some other folks who kind of do these sorts of things, covering state influence on entertainment media, I already was having a hard time getting as excited about typical action movies as I used to when I was a young, dumb kid. But, you know, the experiences I've had, because I started teaching college history in 2006. So I've had just like dozens and dozens and dozens of veterans coming through my class since then. And it's amazing how much in conversation they will either directly or indirectly kind of say that Hollywood films and even TV shows were a big influence on them joining the military. So to me, this entire topic is like absolutely vital to understand and to expose. So I'm curious, your take, kind of zooming the lens out a bit, What's your take overall on this involvement of state, military, and security and intelligence agencies with popular entertainment? And like, what do you think this means in the big picture for society that these things are the way they are?
Well, people ask, it's one of those questions sort of people ask, tend to ask it a bit hopelessly, a bit like they're howling at the moon. Why is there so much war? And in reality, we actually live in an era when there is comparatively little war. You go back, you know, century by century, we're actually probably more people, globally speaking, now than we have been at any time in the last 1,000 years. But nonetheless, there are still relatively constant wars, and certainly your country and my country seem to be involved in pretty much constant wars. So why? Why are these very wealthy, in many respects very stable, Western societies so concerned with inflicting war on the world? And how are they getting away with it? And in particular, that second question, how has this happened? Why is the public not more resistant to this in any number of different respects? And I think Hollywood cinema and big budget TV entertainment is a huge reason for this. That because the way we learn about war and the way we learn about national security, the intelligence agencies, all of these things, is primarily through entertainment, and I would even wager primarily through entertainment that is sponsored by these agencies themselves. As a result, huge numbers of people associate a pro-military way of thinking or a pro-security state way of thinking with things that give them joy and pleasure, with stuff that makes them laugh, that surprises them, that entertains them, that makes them go home with a smile on their face, right? At a most basic psychological level, that's the association that's being made, is this thing that makes me happy is telling me the CIA are a vital, necessary part of the world. So, in terms of trying to understand how is it that so-called democratic Western societies have been able to do this and are still able to do this and continue to be able to do this even in the face of quite considerable public opposition, I think these things probably have more of an influence. I think entertainment has more of an influence than the deceitful news coverage. Because for one thing, a lot more people watch them. Far more people will go and watch, I don't know, the latest Jerry Bruckheimer blockbuster than watch CNN. So, in terms of mass deception, or at least mass manipulation, I think they are more powerful. And I think they're a big factor in explaining why it is that in particular since World War II, the national security state has essentially only gone in one direction. It has only got bigger and more powerful and more destructive. It shows no signs of abating. It shows certainly no signs of reversing. And one of the main reasons why there isn't more opposition to that is state-sponsored entertainment. I can't cite you any hard evidence or statistics proving that, but I sincerely believe it to be true.
Yeah, and I could definitely second that as someone who, you know, is walking around in the end result of this sort of inculcation. You know, my perspective from the other side of the pond is that I totally agree with you that this is huge in people thinking the way they do about these issues. Well, I'm going to wrap up here in a moment, but before we do, you mentioned a second edition of National Security Cinema in the works. Are there any other projects that you're working on currently that you want to mention?
I am working on a film which isn't really a documentary. I guess it's more a kind of philosophical essay in cinematic form that is looking at this from a more philosophical and political angle rather than just looking at the promotion and, you know, furtherance of the security state. I'm not sure when that will be finished, but hopefully sometime this year. So that's a big project I'm working on. Other than that, it's just the sort of, you know, the ongoing podcasting and writing and everything else.
All right. Well, I'll definitely be sure to link to your website in the show notes for this episode. And Tom, I just want to thank you for your time, and I really have enjoyed talking to you.
Thanks for having me. It's been a lot of fun talking to you.
Thank you for listening to the Dangerous History Podcast. Check out the website, profcj.org, or you can just put in dangeroushistorypodcast.com to get the show notes for this and every other Dangerous History Podcast episode. While you're there, you can email subscribe to the site over in the right-hand side, and if you put in your email address there and subscribe, you won't get any spam or anything like that from me, no junk email. You'll simply get an email notification every time something new is posted at my website. You can follow me and the show on Facebook and Twitter as well, and you can subscribe to the podcast in iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, however you prefer to consume your podcasts. If you enjoy and appreciate this show, there are many different ways you can help me keep this show going, growing, and constantly improving. One easy way is simply to spread the word about the Dangerous History Podcast to those you think might appreciate it who don't already know about it. And you can also help the show out by leaving ratings or reviews in venues such as iTunes, which helps the podcast get ranked more highly. If you would like to help out the show financially, there are many ways to do so. And you'll find them at profcj.org/donate. And one of the best, most helpful is to sign up to support the show via Patreon at patreon.com/profcj. And if you pledge a contribution of at least $5 per month or more, you'll have access to bonus episodes that I publish in Patreon available nowhere else, as well as the ability to join the Dangerous History Podcast Scholar Warriors private Facebook group. You can also make one-time or recurring donations via PayPal, and you can donate via Bitcoin as well. And of course, if you buy things from any of my Amazon affiliate links or my Abe Books affiliate links, go through those links, then do your shopping as normal, and the Dangerous History Podcast will get a small commission at no additional cost to you. This has been another episode of the Dangerous History Podcast, helping you learn the past so you can understand the present and prepare for the future.